the church is strychnine, and they got the powdered strychnine that I guess was used for killing rats and stuff like that before. They get the tip of a knife, put it into a quart jar, and mix it up, and that's the deadly thing that they drink. At Ohio State, at the School of Pharmacy, when I was up there, I still have some of the strychnine in the office. But the powder, and then took it down there, they analyzed it and said, yes, in fact, it is strychnine. I had some liquid that they had used in the service, too, and I said, you know, could you analyze the parts per million? And they weren't equipped to do it and sent me over to Battelle, and Battelle said, yes, we can do that for $500, and that was more than I got for being a teaching assistant, so, you know, I didn't have the liquid analyzed, but I've been there when the same powder that was used for, that was analyzed by the School of Pharmacy was used, and there have been some deaths from the strychnine. The strychnine is a horrible way to go because it attacks your spinal cord, the nerves, and actually what happens, all with lockjaw and all, where you have the tightening of the muscles, and you have the tightening of muscles around your lungs, and more or less suffocate from it, as I understand it. You do not build up immunity to the strychnine. It, you know, is out of your system. You're either dead or it'll go out of your system within 24 to 48 hours.
Is that less common than?
Less common, mainly because it's difficult to get now. The availability, they have some pharmacist that they can get it from, but it's less common. The same as the washing of the feet will be less common in many of the rural areas because of the water supply. You know, there may not be water in the church. Yes.
Okay. First off, I want to establish fact. Your talk right here is I'm a Pentecostal preacher and Bible school student.
Okay.
I have a couple questions about their doctrine, okay? Mm-hmm. I read an article last summer about the snake handlers. Okay, it may sound like they're non-Trinitarian or Jesus only. Are they Trinitarian or Jesus only? Or
depends.
Are they a mixture?
Depends.
Depends?
Mm-hmm. And some of your Kentucky churches, they believe in the Trinity, and mm-hmm. And the ones that I studied, they did not, Jesus only.
Okay, and the second question, what did it do with the scripture? In Acts chapter 28, verses 1 to 6, we had the scriptural example of how we are, what Jesus really meant by taking up serpents, where Paul was on this island and was accidentally bit by a snake. What do they say about that? How do they take that verse? Or do you know?
I guess I say glory, hallelujah. They realize, you know, that there are people that are going to be, you know, have other scriptures that are against them. Mm-hmm. They realize that people are going to say that they're crazy. Their definition of reality and religion, which I'm not saying they're right, I'm not saying they're wrong, but I am saying that they do have a commitment to it. They're willing to lay their life out on the line for their belief. Most Methodists, Presbyterians, Episcopalians generally are not. You know, we'll go to Sunday service and that's about it. So that aspect fascinates me, that they have such a deep commitment to their way of life and to their religion. They're willing to practice this. Their family, friends may speak out against them, may kick them out of the family. But it's the price they're paying because they believe this is the right way of life. I didn't want to argue scripture with them. I didn't want to get into that aspect of it because that was not my goal. I was interested in the group pattern, the group behavior that that you had in the rituals surrounding.
Do you have any knowledge about the movement of people into or out of this culture or this church, this group of people?
It tends to
population growing,
the during the 70s, when I was fairly active in studying it, there was a growth in the churches. It was spreading into Columbus, Pontiac, Michigan, Cleveland. There was a growth period there. There was also a period of persecution and the police coming into the churches in Ohio and trying to catch them and trying to shut it down. In the early 60s, what was it, 62, or the state, when the 62 or 63, when they were trying to outlaw it in West Virginia, you got into this whole area of a lot of growth. The majority of the converts come from within the families who have attended. They get some from the outside, but your main support, your main group has a family tie. You have the pattern also of the young people going out once they are early 20s, sowing their wild oats, and then I thought that they were extremely religious and didn't do all these other things, but I was driving a group down to North Carolina, and there was a young boy and a girl in the back seat, and they were making out like mad, and this other young girl in the front seat, and you got to know a little bit about some of the other side's aspects of their lives, and they're normal kids. I don't know. There's a story that I censored, I guess.
How reliable speaking tongues, or is that just your first? Because you can get down and just go to your friend and speak a bunch of nonsense that nobody can understand. Has that ever been validated as real?
I wasn't particularly interested in that, again, because I was interested in the meaning that this activity or the glossolalia had for the people. And for them, whether it's foreign language or whether it was no foreign language that I ever heard, that I'm familiar with. You'll have other people saying, well, I heard some German in there or Arabic or whatever. That, again, that's unimportant. What is important is that this was a sign, first of all, of baptism of the Spirit. This glossolalia, so you have the baptism of the Spirit. Second, I've mentioned the social control, that they use the tongues in this way. Third, it adds authority to what is being said. I'm up here preaching and get struck by the Spirit and I start speaking in tongues. Then it's an indication to the congregation, hey, this is not Ambrose speaking, it's the Spirit speaking to Ambrose. So it adds authority and validates what the minister is preaching about. They've gone down in the adoption spirit, and many of them have prophesied. Someone has interpreted what they were saying. So again, it's one lady told of the death of the minister, saw him in the coffin several months before he's bitten and died. The glossolalia has been used in singing. So. It's used in that way. It's interesting, to find out the patterns, the rhythm that they have sort of differ from church to church and, from one group to another. But yet there are some similarities. But I was mainly interested in, what does this mean to that group?
Could any of the congregation become a minister if they wanted to, and would they have to go through training?
The training, they are... You get into the self-ordination, the individual could set himself up as a minister. Generally, in this one church, the older ministers quiz, there'd be an apprenticeship that they would go through. So through this, they tested them out to see whether they had knowledge of the scripture, the gift of preaching and all like that. It's interesting that the preaching, as the film brought out, depended upon the Spirit. And in one service, the minister was up preaching, and he's there for 5 minutes, and said, "The Spirit isn't with me tonight." Went over and sat down. This was accepted. If you go to your mass or your church service, and the clergy gets up there, and after 3 minutes, closes the Bible and notes and says the Spirit isn't with me tonight, and goes over and sit down and says, what was he doing last night that he didn't prepare the sermon? You know, it's a negative aspect in a middle class, upper middle class community. For this church, it gave him status because he did not try to preach without the Spirit being a part. Yes.
Did the congregation seem to be made up of family, relatives, or were there many outsiders included in the congregation?
It's mainly families. There are other people there, but in one way or another, the majority of them are related to one another. And then there are some from the outside. In the rural communities, it becomes a community activity. The believers are in the service up at the front. Some of those who are searching are in the middle section or maybe up front. Sociologists on the back. But the community would be on the outside, and they would be there looking in the windows, and they would come in when the snakes were being handled or fire being handled, and, leave when they got into the preaching or passing the collection plate. But it's an entire community activity. There are various groups operating at the same time.
Yes. Is this a religion then of basically lower class?
We're talking about the as far as lower and some lower middle class.
There are no other. Sort of what you would say, because the reason why I ask this is, many of these aspects are found in all of the current denominations in the evangelical and I say this from a standpoint of being an Episcopalian.
Certainly.
It's a very strong movement in my church. And, I don't think that we would handle snakes, but, speaking in tongues and things like that.
There's an LPM. Okay, there's one guy that had 2 years of college in the service, and that was the most, I think, as far as education is concerned. The majority of the people in the one study which I did in Scrabble Creek, there were 5 churches in West Virginia, 1 in North Carolina. The adults had about an 8th, 9th grade education, the majority of them did, which is not to say that they are dumb. Their IQs would fall on the normal curve there. The young people had more. You're talking about 11th grade education. In the urban areas, the educational level is higher. Most of them are high school graduates. The older members tended to have less education. Now, if we're talking about income, some of these individuals have a sizable income. One had a trucking, transferring garbage route in Scrabble Creek, as well as a trailer court. So he brought in a heck of a lot of money. A lot of money went out for the church. In this film, Joe Turner's son-in-law is has about $125,000 house. He's into construction and has his own firm and pulls in a bundle. Many of the people in the urban areas will have higher paying jobs, but I would say the majority of them would be lower middle or lower class as far as income and education. Has nothing to do with their intelligence. And I can't emphasize that enough, because I brought one of the ministers into my class at Ohio State, and you're talking about 400 or 500 people being there, and he filled with questions just like that. Did not try to preach or convert, but presented his views. And, yes?
Is there fear at any time in members there of serpents? As I'm thinking of the children. They seem to enjoy that and participate in the dancing, but what and how do parents handle any fears or rebellion in the children at any age?
I haven't seen the fear in the children, mainly because the ones that were there have been around it all their lives. The children are protected. I've seen, when the serpents come out, then if the parent is in, in the spirit, someone else is moving them away. The youngest child that I ever saw handle a serpent was I think he's around 10 or 11 years old, in Cleveland. He had been fasting for 7 days before the minister came up. The minister was there, the child, and the mother or grandmother was beside. The minister held the rattlesnake out. The child took it for 5 or 10 seconds. They took it back and went on. Children are not, generally are not allowed to participate in those signs. But they do have the dancing down. The Dixie, my little girlfriend, was about 5 years old, and she, her mother would be up there dancing, and Dixie, you know, you look at the mother and look at this Dixie, and it's the same, you know, little dance that they were doing. The women would, with their long hair, when the spirit would strike them in dancing, their arms would go out and hands back, and you know, bend at the waist, and their long hair would flip around, and bobby pins would, you know, go flying. So it's, whenever the spirit would go, "Hutshama," like that, and you know, Dixie and the little kids would do the same thing in the back. Yes.
I found the dancing to be as interesting and yet as frightening, perhaps, as a serpent handling. And it almost seemed as though the people were seizure-like at the end. Did you feel uneasy at all about watching that?
I didn't feel uneasy after, you know, being with them for a while. This particular was Joe Turner's son, Donnie. And he would do that, perhaps, that was exaggerated from what most of the people would do as far as the dancing or being struck down by the spirit. Again, that was not as typical as you would generally have. Mary Lee goes into a discussion, as does LaBar, giving it a more Freudian interpretation, saying that the handling of the serpent is public masturbation. When they're down in these states and on the floor rolling around, that you know, that the women are sexually excited, that type of thing, which, you know, is more psychological. I really don't think the people are into that, or you know, their sex lives, talking with them tends to be pretty healthy.
Yes. You've been present and seen hands that have been in the fire, and there haven't been any burns?
You know, things happen, and once you're around this group, Mike probably found this out too with his group, you start to anticipate things that are going to occur. And at the one service, I was up on the side, and if this were the pulpit and this was the dancing area, I was over here on the side taking notes and photographs. And this lady started dancing several dancing in the spirit, but this one that I never met, this first time in the church, and she came dancing over, she put her hands on my head and ran them down and held my hands. And I thought, what the hell, you know? And so I started saying to myself, "I wish you'd handle the fire. I wish you'd handle the fire." To myself, not out loud, you know, several times. Well, she dropped my hands, went up to the pulpit, came out with one of those torches. Now, she held her hand directly above the flame. Now, it's not one of these numbers, you know, or it's not one of these where the heat is bouncing off. Is directly above the flame, so she's getting the full impact of that heat. Didn't have a watch, so I started counting, 1,001, 1,002, got up to 50-some seconds with her without moving it. Now that's, I was excited, cut it in half, 25 seconds, 30 seconds. You know, still time enough to have been burned. Went up and examined her hands afterwards. They were sooty, washed them off, and no blister or anything. the fire is self-hypnosis that they're able to put themselves into, you know, tends to be extremely fascinating. I've seen a propane torch, you know, that you use for welding, those little ones, you know, up and down. Seeing kerosene torches under their under the chin, which generally is a tender part of your body, on their feet. I have seen them get burned from it too, but very infrequent. Getting messages may get the messages may get crossed up. This one guy was had been bitten on the foot by a couple weeks ago, before this one service, where they had a little chase lounge there, and his foot was propped up on a pillow. And this one member was dancing in the spirit with the flame, and he felt that you know, it'd be good if we do that, but the message hadn't gotten to him. So on top of the snake bite, you know, you have someone trying to burn your foot, and he's pulling it back. I'm not in the spirit. When they're in the spirit, I would love to wire them up. I would love to, you know, what happens to the temperature in their extremities, their hands? Because I've held their hands before they've gone in, held them immediately after they've handled the serpents, and you know, they tend to be a little cooler.
There have been some studies done of energy fields surrounding mm-hmm. faith healers,
mm-hmm.
and
sure.
a phenomenal increase in mm-hmm. the energy field when they are laying hands on, mm-hmm. and these are proven faith healers.
Right. Yeah. That's another area that is fascinating, and more is coming out, because the faith healing, it is not necessarily the minister who has this gift. You know, it may be another member in the church who has the gift of healing much greater than the minister does, and they turn to them for their healing. And it's functional. I mean, if we look at most of our illnesses, we're talking about well, some estimates, what, 65-75% are psychosomatic, so that you know, the faith healing does do the job there. Anything else about serpent handling you wanted to ask but were afraid to? Some of you may have gone.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Yes.
Are the snakes sacred, or can they kill snakes, like out in the forest?
They generally don't kill them. They generally don't kill, you know, any of the serpents. Even when the one bit the minister and killed him, they did not kill that that snake. Yes, it was. But they generally do not kill the snakes. They will say outside, when they're not in the church service, that they're afraid of the snakes, the same as you and I are, supposedly. So it's, you know, there's fear there outside, but it's the spirit that enables them to do this.
Is there a typical congregation size, or
the churches vary? Generally, we're talking about a service 40 to 60 people, sometimes small. there may be twice that on, you know, that define themselves as members. They do not have the church role or membership. Mike, what am I leaving out? Anything that you came across that we haven't covered?
Well, I wanted to take this opportunity to introduce Eleanor Dickinson, who arrived while you were speaking.
Okay.
Can you raise your hand? Eleanor has written what I regard as a phenomenal book on the subject of Pentecostal churches that she has studied. It's called Revival. Do you have a copy of it there you could hold up? And maybe you, it's kind of late in the evening, but maybe you would have a few comments or something you'd like to add?
I think we know many of the same people. What I usually do is go live with them and just keep my tape recorder running the entire time. I'm interested in the whole phenomena, particularly the religious expressions of all kinds. So I'm as interested, say, in the faith healing or the speaking in tongues as the snakes. And the only thing I would add is that I've been to a lot of services where they have all the facilities for handling snakes, fire, or poison. And if no one is called, no one will do anything. Right. So it's not for a show. If the spirit doesn't call you to go up, you shouldn't do it. And no one says, like, if anyone wants to visit one of these churches, no one's going to say, okay, Joe, it's your turn to handle snakes today. I mean, they're not loose. And there's nothing to be afraid of. And if you're not called by the Spirit, you shouldn't go up there. If they're not called, they won't either. And it's almost like like the early churches where anyone can preach, anyone can call for healing, anyone. I mean, Joe and the different people will refuse to be called a minister or a leader of the church because they say they crucified the leader 2,000 years ago. So the most they'll let you say is that they're the caretaker. You know, they pay the rent, to turn on the lights or something like that. But if anyone is called to preach, they're welcome. Kind of amazing.
I think that's very important for them to understand that some say, well, you know, you have a camera there or you're an outsider coming in and they're doing this. I don't know how many, and you're probably in the same situation, the meetings you go to that, you know, it doesn't occur. None of the signs will be practiced that night, and you may have cameras there, you may have people from the outside. So it's not that, oh, gee, here is the Alkins News, and I'll be in the paper tomorrow, that type of thing. You know,
they do everything entirely because it's in the Bible. Mm-hmm. And it's not to show off or to be dramatic or because they like snakes or hate snakes or poison or anything else. And they say if you don't think that poison is deadly, bring your dog in. One man came in one night and had a hunting dog, and he was doubtful. Brought the dog up to the front. Dog drank the poison, dropped dead. Man was furious because it was a good hunting dog. And he was walking out and said, hey, mister, come back and get your dog. They said they love animals. They're not against animals. But if you doubt the Lord, you know, come and... I have a fascinating discussion on tape. Four of them stayed till about 3 in the morning one time. I don't show this because it's easy to make a joke out of it, but it's a discussion of the relative merits of arsenic, strychnine, crankcase acid, and rat poison that you wouldn't believe. And their normal formula for strychnine is 67 grains to a pint of water, and that'll kill about 400 people. I haven't tested because that would mean that I would be doubting them. But I've given it, like, to the Smithsonian and different museums, and they, I hope, will test it. I mean, I think it's important that people know, but I feel like it would make me... I don't want to be a doubter of their word, so I won't test it. But they have friendly pharmacists that will give them a strychnine, so there's no reason it shouldn't be. If they were to fake it, then they'd go to hell. So given a choice between going to hell for faking it and drinking the real thing, which would you choose?
Is there a rigid tithing? Or, you know, there's biblical guidelines on that. Or is that a more flexible thing? Monetary upkeep?
Most do. They don't have very much money. They
it's
usually
it's
do,
more or less voluntary type thing.
But they kind of do it on the side, you know. It's not the big deal about passing the plate as part of the service. I mean, they just, you know, I'll take it up later, or maybe your turn to pay the rent this month, or build the church or something. Yeah, they're pretty strict about all this stuff.
Some of them say that they give much more in the sense that they see the tithing as Old Testament, and you know, they go beyond some of the ones in Columbus.
Yeah, I noticed most of the women had long dresses on, long sleeve dresses. How strict are they about wearing, covering the body and modesty?
They're very strict, even to the point that one in the factory where they were making mattresses in Columbus, the one lady would wear a dress there when, you know, she should be wearing slacks as far as, you know, lifting and all like that. But the dresses are longer, and the majority of them will wear long sleeve dresses. You have the absence of jewelry. The one lady who was an LPN needed the watch to, you know, take the heart rate, and she said that she got the ugliest men's watch that she could get, so that it wouldn't be ordaining herself with jewelry. You know, so they're fairly strict in their dress code. I don't know, did you find that with your churches?
Yeah, they won't wear anything. In fact, I have to be real careful. I don't wear any jewelry or makeup or anything, just to attend the service. And it's always surprised me the number of people who come as visitors and come in and say shorts or, you know, they wouldn't go to their own.